Artificial intelligence is making headlines around the world as new and rapid advances reveal its potential rewards and risks. AI systems are now able to perform mammoth computing tasks much, much faster and more efficiently than human minds, incorporating learning, reasoning, and self-correction. Today, the possibilities seem nearly endless and perhaps a bit unsettling, too. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shireen Seward. Today, we hear about the advantages and possible disadvantages of artificial intelligence and how AI systems work. We invite you to join in this discussion today by calling 800-780-9742, or you can email questions and comments to us at ideas@wpr.org. Vera Klekovnya is an associate professor of world languages and literatures who joined UW Stevens Point in 2011, first as a professor of French. The professor was instrumental in developing UWSP's year-long series on the future of artificial intelligence, which included a lecture on how robots could become pets, friends, confidants, and even romantic partners. Talked about all the similarities and differences between robotic and human relationships. Vera, welcome to Route 51.
Thank you very much.
And also with us is Carrie Elsa, an associate professor of media studies at UW Stevens Point. Professor Elsa has performed research in animation, children's media, film, and media history. Her AI presentation in the UWSP series traced the drive to represent artificial life through media technologies, from Edison's mechanical doll to Ridley Scott's Blade Runner. Carrie, it's great to see you again. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Vera, I want to start with a point that immediately strikes me as I was introducing you. The idea that robots can become romantic partners, how is that a thing?
Well, the whole series was born from ideas of how we treat technology as helpers for us, technology as mechanical caregivers, romantic partners, and Sherry Turkle, in her wonderful book, Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other, talks about this robotic moment, the moment we are ready to consider technology as potential confidants, partners, romantic partners. Well, of course, if you're interested in love and sex with robots, I suggest that you read David Levy's book, where he makes the argument that we are ready psychologically to accept technology as much more trustworthy and more stimulating than humans. Of course, that's not what I want to hear, but that's his argument.
I don't think that's what I want to hear either. What about you, Carrie?
Oh, no. I think there's lots of problems here, and I think popular culture has covered a lot of them. So yes. We could get into that.
Well, some people find artificial intelligence really frightening. They find it a little disconcerting. Should we be scared?
That's a very difficult question because, there's lots and lots of ways in which artificial intelligence has the potential, is already making our lives better and has the potential to make our lives much better. But there's a darker side too, right? If the technology outpaces our ability to control it and understand it. So I think that, yes, there's reasons to be afraid, but also reasons to be excited too.
And I guess that really begs the question, why do we need it at all?
Very good question. Well, first of all, let's define it. What is artificial intelligence? It's a compilation of algorithms that perceive information, process information, and synthesize it. So they mimic human intelligence, but of course it's not human intelligence because it doesn't have value attached to the information. People believe in general artificial intelligence, and that's, of course, definitely popular media trying to convey the idea that they will be able to resolve all the problems, help humanity solve climate change problems, for example. But at this stage, what we have is compilation of algorithms. And because algorithms have no value systems, no societal value system, we are facing oppression by algorithms. And one book that, if you're interested in this subject, is phenomenal, is by Sophia Noble, who wrote a book on oppression of algorithms. She is a co-founder of UCLA Center for Critical Internet Inquiry. And so when she discovered that when for her daughter for a birthday party, she was looking for black girls, the first sites that came out were porn sites because that's what algorithms associate black girls with.
Wow.
And so that's the premise of the book. If we are not careful, we are going to duplicate or even expand on oppressive sexist, racist algorithms through AI.
So one of the big issues is that a lot of these programs like ChatGPT and a lot of our AI art simulator, the AI art generators, scrape the internet. So they scrape what already exists, and that includes all of the garbage mm-hmm. that humans have put on the internet. And I like that term scrape mm-hmm. because that is what it does, and it implies some kind of violence too. I mean, there's this it's an amalgamation, right? But it's taking all of the stuff regardless of where it came from, and that's the basis of what it uses to spit out again. So it's with all of the kind of baggage that comes with that.
UW Stevens Point is presenting a year-long series of free community lectures and film screenings that continue now through May. How did that whole thing come about? What was the idea behind having that series?
Very good question. It actually came from my students. I used to teach a course on women's empowerment through media, and the last module in that course was concentrated on The Stepford Wives. And if you remember that book, the whole premise is creation of robots to replace women. And when students discussed that, they were so enthusiastic because this is their future. And I realized I have to develop this research angle in my arsenal. And then I talked to Carrie and we said, couldn't we come up with a series? And we did. And I'm so happy that we found many professors' interest in this topic, and you can go to the website of the series, and you can actually watch every single presentation. It's not only live stream, but it's also recorded.
It's fascinating stuff. Absolutely fascinating. In February, one of the films that was chosen for screening was Blade Runner 2049. This is a 2017 film, so 6 years old. And an October screening featured the 1982 version of Blade Runner. So, Carrie, why were these films chosen? And what did they tell us about artificial intelligence that's still relevant today?
Oh, so much. I mean, both of those movies are very resonant with the issues that we're going to be dealing with in terms of artificial intelligence. The first one asks the question, what is humanity? Does the presence of memory and the illusion of free will mean that you should be granted personhood, even if you're an artificial person? And of course, the first movie famously does not answer the question as to whether Harrison Ford's Deckard is a replicant or not, and it leaves it to the viewer to figure it out. But there's a famous speech at the end of that movie that says, all of this will disappear like tears on the rain, and the big question is, where do all my memories go? Am I not a person if I have memory, if I have experience that can't be duplicated by anyone else? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the second movie, Blade Runner 2049, introduces the ethics of care as well, as Vera talks about and we've talked about in her talk a little bit more, in terms of the figure of Joy, who is a artificial companion to Ryan Gosling's character. So she is a girlfriend, she's a wife, she's a partner in every way, but she's embodied only when she gets a special piece of hardware attached to her to create embodiment. But she manifests all of those feelings of nurturing and care that specifically Ryan Gosling's character needs, and so she adapts to his needs, and she's perfect, and she's beautiful, and she has no flaws.
And she's holographic, and so you can take her anywhere. So yes, definitely brings questions about new advancement in, for example, translation. Mm-hmm. Now you can have not only automatic translation, but also holographic image of yourself translating. Or using Google Translate, for example, to sound as you would sound, only in a different language. So you get this seamless cross-cultural transference of yourself through a holographic image.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so in a way, these movies are kind of training us for what we're going to see. Mm-hmm. And some of it I hope we're not going to see at all. I mean, some of the issues that a lot of movies about AI bring up are flipping terrible. Yeah. Like, cough, cough, Matrix.
The Stepford Wives.
Yeah. So a lot of it is really scary. But then there's other ways in which we see this kind of augmentation of reality that that can give people what they need in many different ways. And some of those things are good, right? If companionship is elusive to you in some way and a machine is the best answer for you, it's hard to say no to that. You know, maybe this is going to help somebody.
I would still contradict because there are billions of us on the planet.
Fair.
And guess what?
Fair.
We have all the arms and legs that work. We can mm-hmm. speak. And if only we learn to connect with each other, maybe we can do a good job connecting, respecting, and honoring mm-hmm. humans that we are. So that's why I think the backdrop of ethics of care is much more important than simply ethics. Of course, legal questions of personhood to machines, if they make decisions, like let's talk about healthcare and mm-hmm. robots, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or diagnosis. So if a machine makes a prediction of a diagnosis and it's wrong not because of its algorithm, but about, for example, electricity glitch, who is responsible? So that's good ethical question, right? However, for me, what's more important is to realize who is going to care for whom, why, for how long, and how it will be reimbursed. So who is going to be paid for that care? And if we don't answer these questions now and we try to replace humans with machines, we're going to struggle because machines will not want to take care of us.
Mm-hmm. When I teach the apocalypse class, so that's how I got into all of this. It's because I teach a class on the apocalypse.
Okay.
And we do a whole unit on robots.
Okay.
And, you know, we watch part of the Matrix and all that. We have this, I have this whole concern about whether if robots are not granted personhood when they have self-awareness, what is going to happen after that? And so these are questions that, you know, coming generations are going to have to deal with. At what point do robots deserve rights?
I think we have to deal with it now.
Mm-hmm.
We should not wait because then it's going to be too late. Again, the algorithms that we're thinking about right now, they are everywhere. Even your Outlook email. The sorting process is done by algorithms. Shops use algorithms. So wouldn't you say that it's everywhere?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's everywhere. You know, we have your Netflix, your Spotify. I teach a capstone class, and I'm having to teach my students how to write their resumes with search engine optimization in mind.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend who works at Trader Joe's, and she was telling me yesterday that they use AI to order their products, you know, because the algorithms know what they need to order for the next week. And so really all of this is everywhere. And so at a certain point, we are going to have to figure out what rights machines and software actually have.
But it stems from the value system of efficacy and optimization. And if we continue to keep that as a value system, then we're not going to value humans because humans actually not as efficient as machines are. So then what do we value? Do we value connection? Do we value personal original thinking, creative, surprising behaviors, or do we want something that is practical, efficient, and optimal? If that's what we value, then I don't think we will continue as humanity for a long time.
Carrie Elza and Vera Klakovkina are our guests today on Route 51 as we continue our discussion on artificial intelligence and the science that surrounds it, the implications of recent developments, and what the future might hold. Ahead, we'll discuss more of the ethical implications of AI, plus what is ChatGPT and Could it replace teachers, novelists, or other workers? And we'll answer your questions, too, when you call us at 800-780-9742. You can also email us with your questions at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seewert. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Shereen Seewert. We continue now our discussion on artificial intelligence with our guests, Associate Professors Vera Klakovnikina and Carrie Elza from UW Stevens Point. Your comments and questions are welcome to email us at ideas@wpr.org or call 800-780-9742. There's a lot of discussion on ChatGPT. It's, you know, this artificial intelligence chatbot. So what is it, and how do we try it out?
All you have to do to try it out is Google ChatGPT, and you do have to sign up. Like, you have to sign up. But I have signed up, and it is seductive is a word that I would use for it. I actually did an experiment. So I signed up to do an experiment because I was going to introduce the film Blade Runner 2049. And I asked ChatGPT to write me an introduction to the movie, you know, with a couple of pieces of trivia, some compelling questions that the audience should consider while watching. And it did give me a relatively serviceable little speech to give at the beginning of the movie.
Really?
But what I discovered was that it was bland. It was boring. It had no spark to it. And so it's pretty easy to recognize text written by ChatGPT because it feels bland. It feels like it doesn't have any imagination. I actually found a student who plagiarized an exam last semester.
Really?
I caught it because that's the thing. It's precise prose. It's structured perfectly, like you would want an essay to be, but it has no spark of imagination. ChatGPT functions by, again, scraping the internet. And so what it does is it's pulling information from all over the place. So some of the information that it pulls and it spits out is actually false. So a human is required for sure to vet the information, just like a human is required to vet the information, or peer review is required. For Wikipedia, that's why we say you cannot use Wikipedia as a source in your research papers, right? Mm-hmm. But ChatGPT works on a conversational model. So you ask it questions, you give it prompts, and it gives you answers. And the whole thing can be structured like a conversation, or you can just ask it to give you, you know, a document of some kind. Yes, it is terrifying. And yes, it's going to get better and better. The new version, which I haven't tried yet, is apparently even better than the old version.
Well, see, for me, it was interesting to see the panic of my colleagues when it came out, because as language instructor, we experienced similar panic years ago with Google Translate, because at first it was funny, it was incorrect. But 2016, when they came out with neural network and machine learning, and suddenly Google Translate became so good. We started seeing students using Google Translate to translate the entire essays, and they didn't have any ethical qualms because they said, but it's my own text. I just wrote it in English, and then it translated in French or Spanish or Russian. And what we started doing with our colleagues, first say, you have to write the co-author, and your co-author is Google Translate because you did not produce this language on your own. And then you need to either memorize this language to make it your own, or you have to be able to produce something similar in a spontaneous situation. And that is not possible. So I think what is happening right now, we see big disruptors in learning process. A learning process takes time. You need this time in order to acquire information, process, and retain it, and then use it, apply it to different scenarios. It is also connected to decision-making. So if we put this to machines will translate for us, write novels. Okay, granted, we have to do it in pieces, but it still can be done. write essays for your exams, what you are doing, you are not processing information, you are not applying it, and you are cheating yourself short of the time needed to make the decisions, to really make connections, original ideas. So what is going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
Will we forget how to think?
Well, that's a good question.
Well, how is it that I'm being good cop? You were going to be good cop and I was going to be bad cop. But what I'm going to say is that one of the potential uses of ChatGPT is, like so many different aspects of AI, is augmentation. And so ChatGPT can be useful in the creative process by asking it questions that then spur other ideas that are human-generated. And so a lot of people are talking about, yes, you can use ChatGPT to write a novel, but you can't just ask, you can't just give it one prompt and say, like, please spit me out a novel with these specifications. You have to help it. It's in the ideation stage. You have to, ask it questions that help you to build out a story and then you to think through the story structure. And then, yes, piece by piece, you can ask it the questions that you need in order to, and this is true of a screenplay too. And this is a problem that we're starting to see when I teach screenwriting. But the fact is that it's here. So we have to kind of use it ethically. We have to figure out how to use it in a way that makes the creative products that we produce better and not let it do the thinking for us. So this is a matter of process and using tools. And we are all in the process of trying to figure out what that looks like.
I'll give you two examples to think of it. For example, translation as a profession has been radically changed by Google Translate or DeepL, which is another type of automatic machine translation, is that it's no longer about translation, it's about post-editing. Mm-hmm. So you look at the translation produced by the machine and then you correct, you make it better because some of the linguistic ideas were missed by the machine. But as humans, we have to realize that any word is not an innocent word. You have connotation and denotation. Denotation is just the definition from the dictionary. But connotation is connected to emotions, feelings, value systems that we attach to this world that stands for representing bigger reality. And so if we forget about that, then we're going to, again, cheat ourselves short of appreciating reality and creating better reality for all of us. That's why I want to come back to the ethics of care. And Joan Tronta, who is a political scientist who wrote a wonderful book, Caring Democracy, Markets, Economy, and Justice. She asked the question of who cares for whom and why do we still have gendered care? Meaning men get a pass not to care because they produce, right?
Sure.
And because they protect. Meanwhile, women are supposed to nurture because they're so good at it naturally. And therefore, they should not even be paid for it because they are getting emotional benefits from caring. And that creates a big disbalance that we cannot come up with a democratic system that is actually going to be caring for all of us.
Well, I read something in the Harvard Gazette. It was a story that was published not too long ago. It said that AI has, quote, great promise but potential for peril. And they point to what they call virtually no U.S. government oversight that allows private companies to use AI software to make determinations about health and medicine, employment, creditworthiness, criminal justice decisions, without having to answer for how they're ensuring that programs aren't encoded with structural biases. So how big a problem is that? I mean, what are your thoughts?
I don't want to say nothing about our all of our beloved government figures.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it's entirely possible that some of them don't even know how to use PDFs. Here's what I'm trying to say. What I'm trying to say is I'm concerned that the level of understanding at the highest levels of government does not match the speed at which these technologies are being developed in Silicon Valley. And there's an editorial I read, I think it was an Ezra Klein editorial, so it was dark. Mm-hmm. but the argument there was that it's full steam ahead over there. You know, mm-hmm. they're moving quick because the goal is to be the first to develop this, that, and the other. And it's, you know, this is a money issue too. You know, this is a gold mine, you know, and the development of these products is going to make a lot of people rich. And so there's no consideration of guardrails. And this is true of ChatGPT. It was leased upon the land in, what was it, November, with just no guardrails.
Right.
And you were able to ask all sorts of questions. There's that famous, was it the Times article, where the reporter asked all sorts of questions and the ChatGPT called itself, it was ChatGPT or was it another one of the chatbots, called itself Sydney, right? Mm-hmm. And said, yeah. I'm in love with you.
Yes, and you're going to, and here's you all don't ways love your I, wife.
And, it was and here's all the ways I would end the world if I could, you know. So
very creepy.
And so that kind of called our attention to this fact that there needs to be regulation, there needs to be oversight. But my concern is that not enough people understand it to be giving it the kind of regulation that it needs. And our inclination is to, you know, let technology do technology's thing if it's going to make our lives better. And, of course, this is how we get to Terminator.
Well, but we also get to the idea of international regulation and also cross-cultural powers trying to harvest money. Pretty much, right? Because it's all about markets and data, big data, mm-hmm. right? So if you're interested in learning about AI superpowers and the role of China, I think Kufu Lee's book is phenomenal, AI Superpowers, where he explains the role of China right now and how all these startups are so prominent in China. And it's I would call it a technological experiment on a scale of entire country, because they generate so much data, and data is needed for machine learning. So they will be much faster at processing this. And I don't know what's going to happen with the rest of the world.
I mean, we could talk about the environmental impact as well when it comes to mining rare minerals, which I know also happens in China. And so all of this information, all of this technology is coming at a cost in so, so many different ways.
Too fast. Mm-hmm. And we have to start thinking about it. Ethical design of AI and robots, because it will sweep us too fast if we are not there to protect ourselves. Again, I am a bad cop right here, but
I'll be bad cop too, because I'll say, if only popular culture warned us about this.
If only. Well, I guess I wonder if you worry too about whether AI will only bring newer, faster, more frictionless ways to discriminate and divide us as humans at scale. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, perfect examples. Again, I'll go back to Sophia Noble's book, Oppressions of Algorithms. They're everywhere in misrecognizing facial features. So white faces are recognized much more accurately than faces of any other races. Why is that so? Well, who are the developers? Right? So you start asking these questions, and then you realize that algorithms are not neutral. And that's, I think, the fear that I have. Mathematics, not very many people love math, right? Mm-hmm. And I think we should, because it tells us that there is information, we can trust information, but information is not innocent, and information is not objective or neutral. Therefore, we need philosophy, we need history, we need literature, media studies, because all of these disciplines help us to understand how to process this information mm-hmm. in well, the service of human society.
And images are not neutral. I mean, way back in the 19th century, forgive me, You know, the word stereotype comes from the printing process. And, you know, when we start getting the mass production of images in the 19th century, people get ideas about those images and images of people. And that's how we have the association of certain images or certain ideas with certain people is the spread of images. This is not, again, it's not neutral. And we could relate it, too, to the prevalence of AI art generators and the kinds of images that they spit out. So there's major, this is the Facebook groups I'm a part of, but there are major arguments happening in groups that are all about AI art generation, about the types of images that get spit out and the types of images that we should be making. Because a lot of times when you ask a beautiful woman, you know, if you ask Midjourney or Stable Diffusion or whichever AI art generator you want to use, it's by and large going to be white. It's going to have childlike features. You know, it's going to be really well endowed, because what these systems are doing are scraping the images that are already on the internet. And that means that the images that already exist are just built upon and replicated infinitely. And so that's an important issue. If we're not actually generating new information here with these AI programs, instead we are replicating and synthesizing what is already there on the internet. And that means all of the human biases, all of the sexism, racism, everything is still there. Just endlessly repeated.
So we are duplicating systems of oppression through algorithms. Meanwhile, we're hiding this fact, or the majority of population believes that it is not there because they get unburdened, for example, to look for information. Alexa will do it, right? Oh, hey, Google will find this information. But are we giving up our own agency? I think we are at some point.
What do you think?
Oh, well, I mean, it's complicated, right? Because so the AI art generator groups that I talk about argue that, no, that I do have agency. I have agency in the prompt that I write. I can be more and more specific in what I ask these programs to deliver. And so my ability to speak to these programs is my agency. So I have a hand in shaping what comes out. And so it maybe is an illusion of control. Maybe there is some control, but ultimately, I think that we are kind of depriving ourselves of the ability to generate new information. But maybe not. I don't know. Like, we're always building upon other people's ideas. This is complicated. You know, I can't say for sure.
It is complicated. That's for sure. Vera Klokovkina and Carrie Elsa are our guests today on Route 51. I will get that pronunciation right by the end of the program, I promise. We're continuing our look at artificial intelligence technology and the way it's changing our world ahead. More on the limitations of AI and what's next for this technology when we return, and we'd like to hear from you too. You can join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward with our guests, Vera Klokovkina and Carrie Elsa. We are continuing now our discussion on artificial intelligence, its challenges, and its implications for the future. What would you like to know? You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or join us by phone at 800-780-9742. What gaps remain in this technology? What can't artificial intelligence replace?
Well, I think that one of the big things that AI can't yet do is be creative and generate things that are truly new and truly surprising. And I know that there are folks out there who are working on this, who are working on having AI mimic human perception to the extent of true creativity instead of just, amalgamating everything that's already out there. But, you know, when I think about and Vera and I were talking about this earlier, this idea of going to going to a new place, going to Paris, and using AI, an augmented reality system to show you the city, right? There's the Louvre, there's the Eiffel Tower. The Eiffel Tower was built by Gustav Eiffel, you know. It gives you a predictable set of responses to images, right? You know, you see this, you see this. But what it doesn't have is surprise, is the joy of surprise. And yeah, Vera was talking about this.
We use that virtual reality to help us teach languages, or we hope that more students will take languages because now they can go to Rome, Paris, Berlin, right, through the comfort of their bedroom if that's where they are learning the language. But for me, what is lacking in that is the direct experience and application of knowledge, where your entire body participates in that experience through senses, through surprise. For example, when you go to Paris and you discover there is a major strike in the metro and now you have to walk for 2 hours to get to Eiffel Tower, that is a great surprise, but also a phenomenal linguistic moment to deal with unexpected situation and to use as much of language that you know, target language, to survive in that culture. The brain that is able to survive that situation gets such a boost of self-empowerment that can last you for years because it will remember that moment of survival, of confidence, of exceeding your potential. You cannot duplicate that in virtual reality. And so that's why I want to go back to the question of ethics of care. Because when first ethics of care appeared as a discipline, it was somewhat dismissed. And it was said, oh, it's a feminine types of ethics. We're not talking about real moral issues and values. But the question for me remains is that who cares for whom? We receive care and we give care on a daily basis. And if half of the population thinks that they should not care because as boys, by the patriarchal system, they were taught not to show that they care. Meanwhile, girls should care even if they don't want to care, again, because the system told them they're natural at caring and they don't need to understand the system. They just should go along with it. We get short-ended by the system, patriarchal system, that is built on sexual imbalances. So instead of spending time on developing a new version of ChatGPT or Google Translate, why don't we talk about developing a system that is caring for all, that allows all of us to get in touch with every single aspect of our psyche and be free to care?
It makes me think, too, about both my children have robots as toys. My son has a Tamagotchi, which I feel very strongly about, and because he hands it off to me to take care of.
Oh,
it's hungry. It needs to be played with. Here, Mom, do that. And my daughter has this little panda where, you know, it's like a baby. You pet it. It closes its eyes. It makes little cooing noises. In a way designed to make her nurture. And so I think about the way that my two kids, and I try real hard, I want you all to understand, to not replicate gender imbalances in my house. But I think about the way that my two kids play with these two different, they are artificially intelligent. And they give the impression of life, even if they're not real. And I think about the way that my two children play with these two different robots, and I there's absolutely a gender element to that.
Oh, definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But also we think that these mechanical caregivers will give us more time to do what? I don't know. But they will take away the burden of, for example, looking after little kids because they need stories to be read 20 times the same evening, or elderly because they need to be reminded of taking their pills, or they need to walk 20 steps and we should wait patiently. But what it's doing is actually taking away the time from us that we could provide care and yet still be happy with what we do. For example, when we prepare meals for our elderly parents, maybe we're not talking to them, but we're still showing care. If a robot is there to take away these tasks, what will be left to us? To talk with an elderly parent who has dementia and who cannot continue a lively conversation? Well, then we're shooting ourselves in the foot again. We are not able to provide care that is caring for both parties.
Interesting.
Well, and I, not to change the subject here, but I know both of us have watched the film Megan lately.
Yes.
With the killer robot. Mm-hmm. And that's the big thesis of that movie, right, is that this is a little girl who has experienced loss. And by giving her a robot to bond with after that loss, instead of actually bonding her, her aunt is depriving her of real emotional connection. And she's refusing to acknowledge that trauma. And the little girl has a serious problem because of it. This is the big idea. It's like human connection cannot be truly replaced.
I'm so glad you brought this example up because I'm more interested in Gemma, her aunt, right? Mm-hmm. So she's overworked, right? She works crazy hours. She's overburdened by everything that she needs to do. She's overstimulated by all the technology that surrounds her and that she creates, and she's undercared for. She doesn't have a partner in her life. She doesn't use kitchen because she never cooks for herself and so on. Do we recognize ourselves in that image?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And so her solution to that problem was to find a mechanical caregiver for Katie, her niece. Here, you can have this toy that will be always on, and then I will be unburdened, and I can continue to do what? The same activities that will make me overworked, overwhelmed and overstimulated and undercared for.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the society we want to continue creating?
No.
And it was not a solution for Gemma. I mean, her world imploded, really.
And that's exactly what Megan was doing. She was optimizing her role of protecting the little girl.
Mm-hmm.
And that took her very far. I don't want to tell people what happens in the movie unless they want to watch the movie. It's a horror movie. You can imagine what happens.
I feel like it's not. I mean, I'm not going to say what happens, but I think that if you've seen anything ever, you can guess.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. What kinds of messages in film have warned us that we may be seeing some pretty devastating consequences of these things? I mean, what more is to come?
Hmm. I don't want to go back to the Matrix. There's a lot, right? There's a whole history of robots in film, and Vera's actually teaching a class on this semester. You could go back to Metropolis. The robot is foments revolution. You can go back to the Matrix, where the big problem, and you don't actually see this in the movies themselves, but if you watch the Animatrix, which gives you the backstory of how we get to that point in the Matrix before the first movie. The big mistake that was made is not giving the AI rights. The robots are not acknowledged as a sovereign nation. And so what happens is that, war ensues. Because actually what happens is that the robots start producing products that are better than the things that the humans can produce. And so the humans buy the products that are made by the robots. And so the human economy tanks and there's fights for resources and like hijinks ensue. But all of these movies are warning us that the identity of AI is going to be one of the most paramount items of importance. When do we grant them personhood? When do we give them legal rights? When do we acknowledge that they are coexisting with us on the planet as other beings? And I think that increasingly that is something that the before we know it, generations are going to have to deal with.
it's unfathomable to me to think about giving robots legal rights or to recognize them in that way. And yet it's a theme that comes up time and time again. When is it appropriate?
Great question. I think now, because with rights, you always have a set of responsibilities, right? You can have someone or something legally accountable for their actions. And that could be a safeguard for things like, you know, robot revolutions and demise of humanity and so on. But we also need to think that media and arts has always been the ideational lab to help us imagine what future can be. So, for example, Ex Machina, it's a 2014 movie, right? But they talk about wetware brain. So that what makes Ex Machina so indistinguishable from a human. I just read this article. University of Johns Hopkins is trying to use brain cells for the computer, and they call it biocomputing, and they claim that it will be a much faster and more agile computer. So my question is, why? Why should we do that?
Why do we want to do that? Why do we want the computers to be creative? Why can't humans be creative? Why do we want to create machines that replicate and replace human thought processes? I think we should just burn it all down. No.
do you think we're ever going to get to that point that when we're this is replacing human thought completely? I mean, or interfering so much with humanity that our whole imagination of what life is going to be so different.
So there's one more movie that I think is worth bringing up in this regard, and it's the 2006 Mike Judge film Idiocracy. And in this film, no one's really running the ship. There's AI who run multinational corporations. And because humans have ceded all decisions to machines, human intelligence has decreased at such a rapid pace that no one can think anymore. And so, you know, this is a movie where, you know, somebody from 2006 finds themselves 500 years in the future, and all of a sudden they're the smartest person in the whole world. And but that's the fear, right, is if we cede decision-making, if we cede the production of information and creativity and all of these things to machines, then what happens to us? Do we then does something atrophy? Do we then not have the ability to think in the same way? Do we lose our autonomy?
Absolutely. And I think another movie, one of my favorites, Her, that brings the idea of AI evolving so rapidly and so effectively that it wants to leave humanity because humanity is no longer interesting. And when I showed to my students, of course, they were very disheartened, said, oh, well, thank you, professor, for giving us another fear of rejection and now from technology.
Well, I want to circle back just briefly. We don't have a lot of time left, but we talked about the race and gender bias. Is there a way that AI could perhaps make advances to erase those kinds of biases? Is that also a possibility?
Well, I think people are working on this. And I mean, especially when we keep getting new versions of the AI art generators, there are people who are actively working to try to reduce the amount of stereotyped images that are produced from generic prompts. So, yes, I mean, I'm sure that there is. And it takes minds far greater than my own to figure out what that process actually looks like. But I know that for as many people who are disregarding this in Silicon Valley, there are plenty of people who are also thinking about it and actively working against it. And that book, Algorithms of Oppression, is a great place to think about what actually can be done to combat this.
And the main argument at the end of the book is Sophia's Noble saying an app cannot solve social injustice problems. We are here to solve that because we truly need to appreciate diversity, truly need to appreciate different cultures, learn from different cultures.
Well, I want to thank you both for sharing your thoughts with us. This has been a fascinating discussion, and I'm so glad you were able to join us today. You're listening to Route 51. I'm Shireen Seward, extending a sincere thanks to our guests, Carrie Elza and Vera Klikofkina. Our producers are Joy Ratchkramer and Kate Spranger. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Joy is also our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program as well as our previous programs at wpr.org/route51. And if you have an idea for a future program, email us at ideas@wpr.org. Next week, we'll be back with another fascinating discussion, and we hope you'll join us. Until then, we're heading out of town.